Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our distinguished guest today is William K. Koblentz, a distinguished San Francisco attorney and civic leader. He was previously a member of the University of California's Board of Regents from 1964 to 1980 and its chairman from 1978 to 1980. He is being awarded the IGS Distinguished Service Award this spring at the University of California. Mr. Koblentz, welcome back to Berkeley.
Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in San Francisco, raised in the public schools of San Francisco, and from there went on.
And you actually went to Lowell High School, I saw.
Yes, and so did my son.
Aha.
And so is my grandson. So we're taking advantage of public education in the city.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
My father was a doctor. My mother was a housewife. And they just said, think, watch, listen. And that's what I did.
And you went on from there. And was there, what was the discussion like at the dinner table? Was there much discussion of public affairs?
Not much. No.
And so what drew you down the path that you finally took? Was it just the opportunity of public education and then finding good instructors that led you where you finally wound up?
Well, I owe a lot to the University of California for virtually giving me a free education. And then when I left the Army, I received under the GI Bill a free education at Yale. Can you imagine what that would have cost me under today's times?
Did the opportunity presented by public education push you in the direction of being such a civic-minded person?
I think there are opportunities. Grab them, take advantage of them. Others have done it before, and you can do it yourself.
Let's talk about your years at Berkeley. When were you here as an undergraduate?
I was here from 1940 to 1942.
And what was the campus like then?
Well, I was very fortunate. I lived in Bowles Hall, and where we got room and board. But it wasn't that much of a ferment going on. We were worried. I was. Where am I going to go from here? The war was starting to split, and then, of course, we had the Japanese. And from then on, you couldn't really help yourself. You had to sort of follow what the government said.
And you were here, I think you just said, for 2 years, and that was mm-hmm. because you had to go on and serve in the war. And,
yeah.
And I guess special circumstances allowed the university to graduate a lot of students at that time in a short period of time.
That's right, because we had finished most of our requirements for whatever degree. I was a bachelor's degree in economics. I probably couldn't have done it otherwise.
So economics was your major?
Yes.
And did that excite your interest, even though it was a very brief time that you
No.
were studying it? No.
It was a major and something that I could at least work at.
And Where were you in the service? Where did you wind up being stationed once you went into the service?
I was stationed mostly. I was fortunate, did not go overseas, spent most of my time in the South, building bridges under the Corps of Engineers.
The Southern United States?
Yes, Alabama and Georgia, Louisiana.
And then after the war, you then went to law school. Why did you decide on a law school career?
Because it was the easiest path to follow. That was all. And Yale had a great reputation, and I could get in Yale at that time. I'm sure I couldn't now. And so I went to Yale.
Were there any professors that especially influenced you either at Berkeley or at Yale that you think back and say, hey, that person really pointed me in a particular direction?
Well, the professors I had were free thinkers. That is, Walton Hamilton, Fred Rosedale, and they said, really, to you, your mind is unfettered. Think. Do.
Did this feed into the background you had gotten in San Francisco? I mean, was that the same worldview for someone who had been educated in the San Francisco public schools?
No.
So it was really Yale and Berkeley that made a difference.
That's right.
So you have the law degree. Did you start practicing right away?
I started practicing. That's true. And then I decided maybe there are other things I should do. And I was able to be enlisted by the CIA and to work with General William J. Donovan, who was before that, head of the OSS. And I worked with him in Europe. And they called him Wild Bill Donovan.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked mainly toward a united Europe. And we worked with the likes of people who were then out of office. Paul Henri Spaak, who was the former Prime Minister of Belgium, Winston Churchill, Robert Schuman. He had the access, and I would just sort of follow along, but to help finance what they were doing toward a united Europe.
Mm-hmm. And this was a terribly important project for the United States, and really the Marshall Plan, the building of Europe was really a very philanthropic endeavor for America at that time. And so you're telling us you were really there when the ground was broken for this project.
That's right. Not that I had much to do with the breaking, but it's true.
And you were young, so as for a young person, that was another extraordinary opportunity.
Oh yeah, I would follow the general. For instance, we'd see Konrad Adenauer, who was then the chancellor, and we started talking to the chancellor. But I said, "General, I don't speak German, French. Oh, we better get a translator in."
and what did this experience leave you with? I mean, because in it must have been afterward that you realized that you had been part of this great endeavor.
That there's a lot more in the world than I ever realized, and there are a lot more people in the world with different ideas than I ever realized.
That's interesting. Let's talk a little about being a lawyer, and then we'll talk about the civic roles that you have played, because I think this European experience must have informed what you've been able to do here at the United States. But talk a little about being a lawyer. What do you see as the skills that students have to have to do the law well?
Well, to not be set in your own ideas, to be willing to have an auditory sense, to listen, and to try to formulate a ground in which both sides can come together. You know, it was Winston Churchill who once said, it's much better to jaw-jaw than make wah-wah. And that's true.
So that negotiating, listening to the other party is key to the law. I guess the public sense is that law is about fighting and conflict. But you're really saying that conflict resolution, maybe even before you get to the court, is important.
That's true.
And how do you think one develops these skills? Is it through the process of doing the law, or is it through a kind of good education that sensitizes you to the differences in the world?
I think it's both. And I think you have to realize that there are other points of view besides your own, and to take them into effect, and to try to mediate, if I can say that, between opposing points of view.
You have been fortunate enough to really experience various kinds of leadership, leadership in the law, political leadership, philanthropic leadership. Let's talk a little about those one by one. What does it take to be a leader in the legal community, somebody who people listen to and follow in sort of shaping the contours of the law?
What's so important is that you have to be willing to listen to what somebody else said. And somebody else may be someone you really don't like or somebody you don't really respect, but they have a following. I mean, years ago, on the campus here at the university, when we had the free speech movement, and there were a number of people that I didn't particularly care for, but they had something to say, and they did have a following. And let them talk.
I know that in your legal practice, you found yourself in the position of representing some of the founders of rock and roll, Phil Graham, I think the Jefferson Airplane, and in looking at your biography that you did for the oral history for the library, I noticed that in the case of some of your clients, you were doing the law, you were listening, but you know maybe that wasn't your lifestyle. So you're an example of what you just said.
Well, it wasn't my lifestyle, I can assure you that. The genesis of that was that Bill Graham was in San Francisco, and he was trying to establish what was called the Fillmore Auditorium. And they were going to close him up. He was different. Mm-hmm. And he came to see me. Why did he come to see me? Well, he said, I understand you will handle civil liberties, but I don't have any money. And I said, okay, I don't care. Well, let's see what we can do. And I represented him, and we were fortunate and won the case, and he opened the Fillmore. And then he sent a group to me called the Jefferson Airplane. And in the group was a singer, Grace Slick. And Grace said to me in our conversation, are you getting much lately? Well, my generation getting much was a little different than what she was thinking of. And I just sort of sloughed it off. And she thought, well, he is getting something, and it's probably drugs. So the word went up in the hip community that I was on drugs, and the airplane had a home on in the city. And my wife and I were invited to a dinner there. And before each plate were a couple of joints. And I looked at my wife and I said, "We're not staying. That's it." And we left. And the reason I wasn't staying, I didn't want to raid and then whatever reputation I had would be blemished by being a drug taker. So I left. And people said, "Ah, then he isn't turning on with drugs. He's kind of straight." As a result, in all of that, I wore a tie all the time. But then the airplane asked me to represent them and all of their peccadilloes. And then along came a group called the Grateful Dead. And I didn't turn on with them either. But I represented all these groups as they got into problems. And there were problems. Problems not only with people trying to take advantage of them economically, but as far as drugs and others are concerned. And I went from there.
It's interesting because the picture of you that's emerging is one of a liberal-minded person, but liberal in the best sense. That is a lawyer who basically isn't going to make a judgment necessarily about a client, but really a judgment about the rights that they are entitled to as citizens of the United States. Because I know that in the 60s, you wound up representing some of the radicals or at least being involved in some of the court processes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for instance, Eldridge Cleaver. And I first said, "I don't like you. And I don't like what you do, but I'll stand up for you." And the same with Angela Davis. You don't necessarily have to agree with them, but they're basic right. And this carried over, if I may jump a bit,
please,
to the University of California. When I felt strongly about certain people and their basic rights of expressing themselves. As a result, it affected the practice of law because people thought I was too damn liberal, as they said. Then along came the Patty Hearst episode, and when she was taken, and on the Board of Regents, among others, was Catherine Hearst. And Catherine and Randy came to see me, Randy, her husband, and said, "We need you to represent us because you're going to be straight on this." So I represented them up until the criminal trial because I am not a criminal lawyer. But as a result, then people started saying, "Hey, maybe he isn't so left-wing." And I was asked then to serve on various corporate boards, including the telephone company and others, because I was a straight liberal, whatever that may be.
So interesting, but being a liberal, you in practicing liberal ideals, you know, as they go back to Western civilization and John Stuart Mill, was in a way a process of public education.
Yep.
Because people came to see that you were a man of principle, but you could still be on corporate boards and still do real estate law.
Yep.
Yeah. Very interesting. Now, I have the sense that you were in many ways fortunate to be present at the creation, to use Acheson's terms, of the California dream. You were close to the first Governor Brown. You were in a cohort of friends of people who became leaders in California. Christopher, the former Secretary of State, comes to mind. Cecil Poole, a number of people. So that was really during the Brown era. That was a glorious period for California realizing the middle class dream.
Yeah. I mean, when you consider there were this group of us, Cecil Poole, who was African American, who subsequently became a United States District Judge, then the United States Court of Appeals Judge. But I still remember when Cecil and I went to Sacramento, and we weren't going to bring our families because we weren't going to stay very long. And I got an apartment. And the landlady was quite reluctant to lease to me because she said Mr. Poole would be there. And I figured the only thing I could do was to break the so-called ice was to jolt her. So I threw my arms around Cecil, kissed him on the cheek, and said, "We're lovers." With that, I got the lease. Cecil never forgave me for that. But as a result of that, somebody standing with us was C.K. McClatchy, who became a very close friend. And C.K. was head of the McClatchy newspaper chain. And as a result, Cecil later on asked me to be the first outside member of the family to go on the board of the newspaper chain.
Very interesting. And tell us a little about that time, because it was a time of opportunity for you and your cohort in building, helping to build California, if even just as informal or formal advisors to Governor Brown. It leads one to ask, what changed? I mean, California is becoming a very different place now. So give us a sense of what you think was the foundation for building the California dream, which indirectly you were a part of.
Well, California was then an affluent society, and we were going to build upon that. And as a result, we were able to get through a water bill. We were able to get through fair employment practices. And all of these measures that people were willing to accept. Why? Because it didn't bother them in their own damn backyards. Mm-hmm. And so we took advantage of that. And with the help of the legislature and far-seeing people like George Miller, Hugh Burns, who were willing to help on this, put through this legislation, which Pat enthusiastically supported. And no one could say to Pat, "You're doing this for your own advantage." Mm-hmm. It just wasn't true. So people accepted the governor, they accepted the legislature, and there weren't term limits. So the legislature could stay on and try to clean up whatever mess there was. So things changed. People started grabbing a hold of their pocketbooks, saying, "This is going to cost me money," and we go from there.
So there was a real... There was resources. There was California was affluent, as you just said, but there was a sense of the public good.
Oh yes, the University of California benefited by it. As long as the university was succeeding, like it was, we can tolerate these liberals or these left wingers. Mm-hmm. But in many ways, the university was the goose that lays the golden egg. The university was turning out bright people who were adding to the resources of this state.
Now, you never chose to run for public office. Why
never.
Was that? Why?
I felt close to my family, and I turned down being a judge, both federal and state, because I thought I could do more than possibly in either public office, running for public office, or for meditating and coming out with maybe some good ideas. But I knew I wasn't any Brandeis, and I knew I wasn't as good as some people thought I was.
It would be interesting to have you comment on the extraordinary leadership in the Democratic Party, especially in the 60s. What, looking at people like Pat Brown, John Kennedy, Jess Unruh, do you see any common qualities in them beyond, you've already suggested there was a sense of the public good and working toward it. Any other things beside that that strike you about these liberal politicians?
Well, and then you bring them up to date. Bring up a Barbara Boxer or Dianne Feinstein, who really cared about the public good and what they could do and are still doing for the public. I lament the demise of some of those who've gone by, and I don't think that some of the candidates we have for public office now are up to snuff, as we would say, but I have hope. Well, and I was also going to say that having tenure in office helps a great deal. And I look at the quality that we have in our legislature and in my own local board of supervisors, and I sort of cry and wonder, what's going to happen to us all?
There was in that time a sense of civility and bipartisanship that we don't see today.
No.
And why do you think that happened? Was it because we entered an era under which everybody was out for themselves and their own interests, and they, you know, to hell with the public parts, to hell with the university and so on?
And money. Look what it costs to run for office, even at the lowest level nowadays. That's so important. And so when I'm looking at you, I'm looking to the side, where am I going to get those funds that I need, I think I need, to run for this particular office?
Mm-hmm. Now, when it came time to in some way take a public position, and you were close to Governor Brown, and as you said, it wasn't the judgeship you wanted, and so on, but you asked to be on the Board of Regents of the University of California. Tell us about that and why you wanted that.
Well, I the University Regents used to be, as they would say, the College of Cardinals. And when you look at the people who were on the board, whether it's Mrs. Hurst or Mrs. Chandler or Norton Simon or Ed Pauley or Ed Carter or Mrs. Heller, these were people who felt very strongly about higher education and what could be done and what they could contribute to it. And I thought, damn it, maybe I can do the same. I couldn't do that much on the Supreme Court. And I'm not that good. And that's why I wanted to be on the Regents. And for 16 years. And I thought, maybe I can do some good here. It was very difficult. Difficult not only because of my compatriots on the board who were more conservative than I, but the students weren't helping very much either, especially when you had People's Park. And so many of the students had no auditory sense. They didn't listen. But neither did some of the members of my board listen.
So did your skills as a negotiating, which were evolving and you've already identified as a key skill, did they become very important in this period?
Yeah, very much so. And trying to not cross swords, but say we weren't at cross purposes with members of the board. And the papers weren't helping very much either.
The newspapers?
Yes. And they were far more important than they are now.
When in this period we're talking about for the university, there was a movement from Governor Brown, who left office, and then toward Governor Reagan, who came to define the new worldview, shall we call it, which actually, and the movement from one to the other is really what you've just described, the movement from the public good to the narrow private interest. Talk a little about the different way Governor Brown and Governor Reagan related to the regions.
Well, Governor Reagan had his own friends on the regions. And when it came to the students, there wasn't very much tolerance for their point of view. And at times, I couldn't blame him. The words that were thrown about, I once got so mad at the governor, I called him a menopause Cary Grant. I shouldn't have. But I didn't apologize. But you did have the conservatives who felt very strongly about the university. We're paying your way. God damn it. You listen. And it was tough.
Compare moving the students to a more moderate position in the role that you have versus moving your colleagues, conservative colleagues on the region. Were they both special cases, or were there common elements in the way you dealt with both?
Common elements.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your willingness to listen, to rationalize. You can't do it all the time. But at least I'm going to listen to you. And I agree with you on this and don't agree with you on something else. And then to try to backdoor on some of these things, I had friends on the media, certainly the McClatchys, the Hearsts, and I represented for all his time a columnist, Herb Cain, and Herb was my friend, and we'd slip in a few things, which helped a great deal.
I sense that in your career, you were really on the cutting edge of experiencing change. Here you were representing these rock and roll groups. Here you were, aware of what was going on the campuses. And did your liberal values help you to see the change was coming, even if we wouldn't change completely?
Yeah.
Talk a little about that, because it must have been an important input in what made you a great negotiator.
Yeah. Change was coming, and let's try to go along with that change and mold it along some of our thoughts. That's what you do. And you say to somebody, hey, look, that student isn't so bad after all. Because look what he or she is trying to get across. You may not agree with everything, but some of it makes sense. And the things that some of them were saying, come on, forget it. Just go on from here.
Now, the change that we're experiencing now is one in which the two sides, say the left and the right, no longer listen to each other. They don't talk. And why did that unravel, do you think? And what can be done about that?
Because there's less tolerance on both parts to listen and to try to do things, to change things. What I've seen of Massachusetts, there's a change there. And man, you better understand what it is. You may not agree with it, but do it.
Mm-hmm. And so the flaw of not listening is true of both sides.
Yeah.
You're suggesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, an important theme in your career is philanthropic leadership. You served on, in addition to the University of California Regents, numerous charities and boards and so on. And what have you learned from that experience about what the philanthropic community and even the corporate world can do in the way of serving the public good?
Well, I now serve on the board of the Corrette Foundation. And I think that in many ways we can do good, not by making an enormous gift, but to jolt things along that goes with our perspective, our point of view. And I think in philanthropy, you have to be able to sit down with people. Some people get sort of flooded with their own conceit after accumulating a large sum of money. And then, I don't want something from you, but hey, here's something that may be worthwhile.
So that there is, you're even in this other role, you're still trying to educate people, in this case, the fellow members of the board, to actually see the diversity, to see change, and sort of bring the board's values together with these new forces in society.
Well put, yeah.
And have you been successful at that in these various roles?
Some ways, sure.
And is it your personality that makes this work? Is it your skill as a legal negotiator? Let's give yourself credit here. Can you do that? Because a student may watch this and follow your example.
Well, you try to lead also. I mean, I don't have that means, but to give. But also willingness to sit down and to talk about this. You know, how did you feel about this black experience? Well, I've been a member of the NAACP for 40 years, and I've seen some of the things that the blacks have done that I sure don't like. But on the other hand, look at the other side. Have to be willing to sort of sit jaw-jaw and not make wah-wah.
And this goes back to your days in Europe and seeing what it took to rebuild Europe. Yes. And watching people like Adenauer and Churchill.
Yes, yes. And General Donovan talking to them.
And so what do you see as critical to restoring the sense of civic responsibility, the sense of the public good? It's not a lost cause, is it?
It's not a lost cause, but it's for your own good, damn it. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to start complaining about these students, what can we do? What can we do to make a semblance of order here that's for the public good and it's for your good too? too.
And what do you think the university should be doing to build the support that it had in the golden age?
Boy, that's a toughie, because you're going to have to deal with a legislature that's limited in term, that has no perspective, that I think, on what's going on, but also to educate what the hell does this mean for people of California. And it's not only the legislature, it's you, the taxpayer, who are going to have to pay for this. The more uneducated you have, the more problems you're going to have. Let's look at it that way.
If students were to watch this program, what advice would you give them as they prepare for their future? Because, you know, on the one hand, you're an example that's worth emulating, but you're suggesting that the institutions are broken, are very different. And so that creates a Herculean task. So it's not enough to have the values. People have to, and students have to work the system in a different way, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, I guess so. To use an old expression, join the Goya Club. Mm-hmm. What's that? Get off your ass. Mm-hmm. That is, you have to earn a living, of course, but there are other things in life besides that. Find them, whatever they may be, mm-hmm. and do something.
So this is a call to arms for public service.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. How do you think the university can be drawing students to public service in a time of constricted resources, in a time when we're going to have to look to out-of-state students who can afford to pay high tuition to finance the place?
It's up to all of us who believe in education and to join together, or at least move forward to support the things that we believe in, small as they may be. But the university is so important for all of us, for me and for you, because without an education population, we're going down. And down, I mean, like a southern state that really doesn't care about their citizens. And they don't care because they don't support what is so important.
On that note, Mr. Koblenz, I want to thank you very much for coming on our program. And also for all that you've done for the university and the Regents and in other ways. And we look forward to the awarding of the IGS Public Service Award. It's well earned, and thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.